This week on the Canadian Tech Podcast, we discuss how a class action lawsuit against Amazon or Uber might go, women are now the dominant group in gaming, and Netflix's half-hearted attempt to stop border jumping. That's all next on the Canadian Tech Podcast.
Welcome to the Canadian Tech Podcast, episode 59 for Friday, February the 12th, 2016. My name is Stuart Clark.
And my name is Derek Silva.
Well, Derek, winter has returned with a vengeance in southwestern Ontario. I don't know how much, I don't know how much snow you got out Kilworth way, but we got about 30 centimeters here on the ground in northwest London, Ontario, and it's bloody cold.
Kilworth got about a little bit more than a third of that.
Okay.
So we're dealing with a lot less snow, and I'm not complaining.
I'll send some your way.
No, keep it. Keep it here, okay. Keep it downtown, keep it on the East End, just keep it within the city borders, and I'll be happy.
And you'll be happy. I don't know. I may have to contact my lawyer about that. Speaking of that, how
I have her. She's here. She's on my
She's
side.
Here?
Literally on my side.
Literally on your side. Okay, yes. Derek, why don't you introduce her to us?
So we also have joining us today Susan Toth. She is a local lawyer here in London, Ontario. She specializes in labor and employment law, as well as some general civil litigation. As well as being a lawyer, she is also an adjunct professor at Western University and Brescia College. Brescia College University at Western or something like that. Susan, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
No problem.
It's awesome to hear from you again. I've had Susan as a guest on other podcasts.
Yes.
Very, very smart person. She's much smarter than both Derek and I combined. So
probably.
Yeah.
I can do anything about the snow, though. That might be just outside my jurisdiction.
All right. Well, you know, I was hoping as long as you can keep us out of trouble.
Okay. I'll do my best.
That's all I ask. Okay. Well, one of the reasons we have Susan here is because, again, as being a lawyer, there's some interesting stories actually involving the law on that and technology this week. So we thought we'd have a professional, unlike us rank amateurs, kind of talk about it a little bit. So, Derek, why don't you – the original story that we really wanted to get Susan on for is our very first one. So go ahead.
Yeah. So this article is a few weeks old. It's about a month old. But this is an issue that younger companies like Amazon, Uber, Lyft, and so on, have been dealing with for the last year and a half. And the issue is that a lot of these companies like to hire people as contractors. Normally, that's fine. However, they're treating these contractors like employees in the sense that they're mandating that they show up at certain places at certain times. They're, you know, trying to enforce control over breaks, lunches, etc. And I think the workers, rightfully so, are feeling like, you're not treating me like a contractor. You're treating me like an employee. Therefore, I should be entitled to benefits, you know, standard break time, standard lunch times, you know, depending on the state or the province here in Canada. And I must say, personally, I'm a little sympathetic because if you're going to enforce employer-like influence, I'll say, over a contractor, then contractor might not be the best way to put it. And so, Uber's been sued. I think Amazon's being sued by contractors from a third-party company who are actually told to show up at Amazon in the morning, get your work assignment, go do it, and then, like, literally, you're only reporting to Amazon. Lyft, I believe, is also being sued. There's a whole bunch of companies being hit with class action lawsuits over this very issue, and I really wanted to have Susan on to hopefully shed some light on the Canadian perspective about, you know, how would this sort of thing be dealt with here? Does she know whether it's happening here? You know, could we expect perhaps similar class action lawsuits here? Just the Canadian perspective on this whole issue of contract workers for places like Uber, Lyft, Amazon, et cetera.
Because it definitely sounds like a different relationship when, you know, traditionally we think of a contractor as someone who typically makes more, who comes in for a specific problem.
Yeah.
This sounds more like temporary staff. And we've seen there's more and more of these, you know, employment agencies and stuff like that. But again, even them, if I have a job through Kelly Services and that, and I go in, yeah, I'm treated like an employee. I still get my lunch and my breaks and stuff like that. So right. I agree with you there. So Susan, what do you think about all this?
Well, you know, this is a perfect example of companies trying to push the envelope a little bit and having their cake and eating it too. Because what ends up happening is that an employee is covered by multiple legislation. So you've got your Employment Standards Act, Occupational Health and Safety, and it costs companies more money. There's no way around that. There's statutory deductions that they have to pay, and of course, lots of laws that protect employees who are being terminated from their employment. So it makes sense for companies to try to find ways to save by going the independent contractor route. Now, I don't know of any Canadian-specific cases involving these new companies like Amazon or Uber, but I think it's only a matter of time. The courts have looked at when is somebody an independent contractor, when are they an employee, and intention of the parties is only one small part of that puzzle. They will look at the actual facts of the case. So as Derek, and I think as you pointed out, Stuart, they're going to look at things like how much control does the person have over the working hours? How much control is the company exerting over how the job is done? You know, do they own their own tools? Do they have their own vehicle and things like that? And then the courts usually analyze them on a case-by-case basis, although they follow some guidelines about to try to figure out. And I think the important thing is that it doesn't matter what you call yourself. The courts are going to look behind that.
That's good to hear. I'm Leo, from a potential contract employee perspective, it's good to hear that, you know, they're not just going to look at specifically, you know, the original agreement or that sort of thing. They're actually going to look at, you know, how they're being treated, which I expect is what these American contractors are hoping for.
Absolutely.
Look beyond the agreement, look at the way we're being treated instead, and make your determination on that, Mr. or Mrs. Judge.
Exactly.
Yeah,
and
I think
they'll look at a contract, and what's fascinating is companies will, of course, try to anticipate what a judge will look at, and you'll see a contract, and it'll say, the parties intend for this to be an independent contract relationship. We are and they'll keep repeating that throughout the contract. And even so, the judge is going to say, well, let's look at what's actually happening and whether or not, because they recognize that inherent in an employee contract is a disproportionate amount of power in the employer's hands, and the recognition that we need to protect people who are vulnerable, who need work, who are desperate, especially in the current economic climate, and do what we can to protect them.
Yeah, I think you've basically covered what I was going to say there. And, you know, and again, this goes to a much greater issue, but we talk about how, you know, especially these publicly traded companies who seems like their only concern is making sure they make, you know, they make good numbers in the next quarter.
Mm-hmm.
And in a lot of cases, it would actually be cheaper for them to treat their employees well. So there's less turnover. You know, they are part of the community in that. And I think what happens is in some of these cases, you've got places like Amazon and that they're so big now that, you know, it's almost like some of the big banks with the bailout. It's are you going to, you know, we're too big to risk failing. And I think that's in some ways they're looking at that. And I think there really needs to be a change in how we look at contracts and temporary employees and stuff like that. Like I've always maintained, particularly with like temporary staff, job agencies, if a company hires someone for, let's say, a file room clerk as a quote-unquote temporary basis for more than 6 months, after 6 months, they should have to hire that person full-time. And they can't pull a trick like, and I've heard of this happening, where they'll basically let someone go and they'll either hire someone else or the next week later they'll hire the next person back.
Yeah,
and you know, there are cases where people have been put on these short-term contracts, 6 months and then another 6 months, and if you do that continuously, the courts will actually say this is the equivalent of an employment of indefinite duration. So courts are pretty good at seeing through those tricks. The problem is if the penalty is a little penalty here for this employee, a little one there for that employee, they still could ultimately be coming out ahead. So it's not until you see these class actions where you're looking at $300 million settlements that the companies say, okay, that's cut into our profit margins. Let's go back to employees. But until that happens, they're just writing this off. They're like, okay, we'll give that guy 10 grand, fine. We're still making a profit on taking advantage.
And it also poisons the employee-employer relationship because like you say, that example, they go to court in that, you know, what are the odds they're still going to be working for that company?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, exactly.
Lawyers are expensive.
And lawyers are expensive, yes.
The good ones,
and
right, good ones. Like Susan.
Good ones like Susan. Exactly.
Well, I think it'll be interesting to see what happens here. Uber seems to be getting their way in most municipalities. So if they continue to grow and piss some people off, they will probably inevitably have to deal with this sort of issue here in some province or municipality. Lyft, I think, operates in Canada, probably just in the larger cities, because I know they're not here in London.
Right.
But even, if Amazon opens up more fulfillment centers here or starts to try and drive down their costs here, and this starts to impact them as well, or similar companies, Walmart, The Bay, et cetera, anybody who's trying to go this route. We could actually see a fairly sizable lawsuit at some point.
I think more people are aware of it. I think back to what I believe was last year, the year before, where the Royal Bank, they actually were going to outsource to India, and they laid off a pile of people, because they were saying, oh, we can't find talented people. They were laying off a pile of people, and then those people had to train their replacements.
Yeah.
And that got a lot of PR, a lot of press, and they had to reverse that. So,
I think that made
people more aware of the issue. So hopefully, we'll start seeing this. Like, I like Amazon too. I prefer shopping local, but at the same time, for stuff you can't get, it's a nice way they've done it. They've made a good model there. But yeah, they have to also remember about, if you start pricing people out and people are unemployed, it means they can't afford to buy books.
Yeah, that's true.
In the end. So, okay, let's move on to something a little bit more fun. This is something I actually picked up.
That was fun for me. I don't know.
Okay. Fun for in general. I know. We'll have some more fun stuff for you as well. So this is what I noticed over the weekend. I was helping Carmi Levy with his Tech Tips with Carmi show on Saturday, and they had a couple of people from London's gaming community. There's quite a few gaming companies here. And two of the larger ones, this falls right into this. Adult women, believe it or not, it's not teenagers, pimply teenage boys in basements, but adult women are now the largest gaming demographic. People like my wife, Susan, do you play games on your smartphone or iPad or anything like that?
I don't. I'm a legal geek, but I'm afraid I'm not a gaming geek.
You're the exception. I'm sorry.
No. She's part of the 54%?
Yeah.
64% that maybe aren't playing.
I remember playing Super Mario Brothers as a kid. That's about.
Well, there we go.
Okay, so it's not like you haven't gamed before.
All right. Well, Derek, that means she can stay.
Okay. Yeah, she can stay. I'm not going to kick you out of the room.
Okay. But anyway, there is a Daily Dot report that adult women are now the largest players of games, and it doesn't surprise me. I look at my wife; she plays My Singing Monsters and The Sims and a ton of different stuff on the iPad. And other ladies I know play Candy Crush and all sorts of different things because it's more of a social thing. And everyone has a smartphone. Not everyone has a gaming console, but everyone has a smartphone. So, what else I find interesting? The average game player is 31 years old now. So.
Yeah, I'm 32, so I'm just above that average.
You're a young pup. I'm not going to go there.
Yeah.
But it's true, and you look at how much money that are in in-game currency, and I look at some of these games, like I said, like My Singing Monster or The Sims Online, and my wife doesn't buy a lot of in-game currency, but she's bought a little bit. But I know people that are really seriously into this, and companies like we've talked about Big Viking Games and Big Blue Bubble before are really addressing this because that's what they're that's one of the things they're looking at now when they do surveys and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So, don't assume the stereotype.
Yeah, no, I think this is great. It's fantastic for gaming companies, it's great to open up new markets and stop ignoring half the population. And, even if the games are generally a little bit different, that's fine. I'm sure there are men playing female-dominated games and vice versa, or, you know, more women playing what are typically, you know, a male-dominated or a mostly male game like a Call of Duty or something like that.
I have a friend of mine. She can kick my ass in Call of Duty.
I bet she can. In her sleep,
probably.
Any woman who's played Call of Duty for more than 6 hours could probably kick my ass at Call of Duty because I'm not a big first-person shooter fan. So it's just not my thing. But, you know, it's great. I had a strong feeling I had to do primarily with what are called casual games or social games, and that seems to be true. But yeah, I really feel like this trend probably started with, you know, Dance Dance Revolution type games and The Sims and roughly 10 years ago, you know, getting stuff out there that more women would find appealing versus, you know, what I would generally say is probably a minority of women interested in first-person shooters or Grand Theft Auto where you're stealing cars and killing people for their cars and stuff like that. I mean, like, even I'm not a fan of those types of games. So it's great. I'm glad to finally see some sort of balance come to the industry as a whole, even if we have some other darker, more underlying issues to deal with.
Yeah, we could talk about Gamergate for like hours on
that. Let's not.
Let's not.
I acknowledge the issue exists. I acknowledge my part in just trying to stop people from being jerks, but I don't want to get into the whole Gamergate thing.
Yeah, exactly.
What I think would be interesting to see is how the gaming industry responds to these demographic changes. Because I don't know enough about the issue, but I wonder how much is just inherently, you know, people having cell phones and playing on their phones instead of having actual gaming consoles. Because now that we know that this is happening, I see lots of industry where it's such a wasted opportunity, and I see so many beer commercials that are aimed just at men, and I think, a lot of women drink beer. Like, you are really wasting a really powerful advertising opportunity. So it'll be very interesting to see if the gaming industry, which I think is fair to say is still very much dominated by male software developers and gaming engineers, what their titles are, will they be able to recognize this opportunity or won't they?
Exactly.
We should find out from Big Viking. Big Viking, if you're listening to this podcast, please call in.
Big Viking, Big Blue Bubble, Digital Extremes, anybody. Yeah. Anybody that's making games in town.
Yep. No, I think we're seeing a change with some of the firms in town. It's slow but sure, but, you know, there you go. So, all right, moving on. Derek, this is one of yours. Fitness trackers, Bluetooth devices, stuff like that.
So,
really?
Thank you.
A privacy issue?
No. Privacy issue amongst the Internet of Things? No. Never.
Say it ain't so.
So thank you to cybersecurity researchers at the University of Toronto. They took a look at 8 popular wrist-based fitness trackers and found overwhelmingly that you're able to get a lot more data out of the devices than you should be. You know, these are typically really closed ecosystems. You know, you get a Fitbit, it communicates with over Bluetooth via the Fitbit API, and you get your data from Fitbit.com and that sort of thing. You know, that's not necessarily great for the future of this industry, but you know, generally speaking, that's the way you expect it to go, and so you don't expect this sort of thing to be, or you hope it's not easily accessible outside of the service. But what you're finding is that it's really easy to find these devices if you have like a fairly open Bluetooth scanning device or even your phone with the right app, and they seem to be hanging on to a lot of location data, which is obviously not good. You know, it's one thing to send it up to the cloud again, like I mentioned, but you know, being able to extract that from these devices is also not okay. And basically, you know, someone with the right skills and the right tech can eavesdrop on a lot of your data. And unfortunately, this is just continuing the litany of security problems we've been seeing with Internet of Things type devices for the last few years. It started with routers a couple years ago where we found a big cybersecurity hole amongst a lot of the firmware used across a lot of different devices, and these Fitbit, Garmin, Jawbone, these guys really need to buck up and make sure that the data is only available using the tools that it's supposed to be accessible with. And it's a whole rethink that needs to happen across this industry.
I think a lot of it is, as you say, you know, making sure the devices are secure and whatnot. But we also have I'll kind of slightly press back, because the way some of the things in the article was written, like you have one guy fires up his phone, he says, oh, yeah, here's a Bluetooth device here, there, and everywhere. Well, you know, as you say, it requires a rethink, because for a Bluetooth device to talk to another one, usually it has to know what it is.
Yes.
It's just like if I'm driving around with my smartphone, you know, with Wi-Fi, as I go, if I go to a place and I've never been there before, it's going to show me all the access points.
Yes.
You know, and for some people, you know, that's more easy. But it's definitely, you know, there's kind of two things here. There's the how anonymous do you want to be, and do you want to do it at the expense of, you know, privacy? Well, you know, do you want to do it at the expense of your privacy and stuff like that? I think there's a lot they can do. For example, you certainly could do what routers do, where initially they're set up and you can say they can advertise themselves. But then once you have your device hooked into it, you could basically stop that thing from transmitting. Now, in the end, someone who knows what they're doing, they're still going to see it, because by its very nature, it has to let the other person say, hey, I'm this Fitbit.
Yeah.
Even if it's talking to the known good device. So,
I see a lot of problems with pairing there, because it is ridiculously easy to pair a device that's in pairing mode most of the time. It's like,
exactly.
Oh, please put in the passcode. The passcode, 9 times out of 10, is 0000. It's like, it's really just an acknowledgement, like, yes, I actually have the connecting device in my hand. And, you know, I definitely actually want to pair up with this device that's communicating with me. But, like, my wife ran into a situation a few years ago where a coworker who just happened to be driving beside her down Queens or something, she could hear his conversation over the Bluetooth speaker in her car. Like, it just auto-paired, didn't ask for a passcode. And so, you know, she's trying to get his attention, like, through the window, like, hey, whoa, what's going on? Like, I can hear your conversation, like, turn off Bluetooth or whatever you need to do. But, you know, the light turned green. And so she hit the hang up button or something. Like, it's not, she wasn't trying to listen in. It just happened. And, with this research here, like, they're finding that the Garmin app, it sends your heart rate, workout, and movement data across the internet without encryption.
Yeah, and
there is
an issue.
Reason for that to happen.
Exactly.
And another with Jawbone up 2, somebody could falsify his walking data, and so he made it look like he walked from Toronto to Quebec City. That's
on
not
a
short walk.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, that's just, you know, normal Saturday, 800 kilometers later. So, you know, it's,
I bet his heart rate was good.
Yeah. I bet he was like 180 beats a minute at the whole time.
Well,
so why things, Xiaomi, Neo, everybody needs to get their stuff together and make sure that, you know, that these devices, that the data coming out of these devices can only be used in the intended manner.
Right.
I think there is one other issue, though, that needs to be, that people really need to understand when they have these devices, is that even the best encryption is not going to protect you from a warrant if somebody wants to find out your information. So beyond just, we need to tighten whether or not other people can look at your data without, or easily at least, you need to consider that as soon as you have those devices, your privacy could be at risk if somebody from a peace officer wants to find out where you've been. So if you're the subject of investigation, that information could be subject to a warrant, and all of a sudden where you were at certain times of day can be sent to the police for their investigation. And if there's any chance that data could be wrong, or worse, that it could actually be manipulated, you know, that could impact not only criminal investigations, but let's say on if you're trying to claim long-term disability, for example, you could have an insurance company saying, look, you walked 800 kilometers from Toronto to Quebec, you're clearly not disabled. So there are other implications that I think people need to worry about beyond just your neighbor you know, being able to hack into your Fitbit device.
Yeah. So really what that means is, and I learned this from the Serial podcast last year, is if you're going to commit a crime, you leave your cell phone at home, leave your fitness tracker at home, you go completely techless so that nobody can use that sort of thing against you in court.
That's the advice I give all my clients before they're going to commit crimes.
Exactly. Never mind the satellite's still gonna track your every move.
Or your
sorry.
CSIS doesn't have the NSA satellites. Come on.
I don't know. How do we know CSIS isn't really running the whole thing?
I was going to say could maybe all be CSEC. Yeah.
The Canadian connection, I keep telling you, man.
Yes, of course. Sorry, we need to find a Canadian connection. CSIS, leave me alone.
There you go. Okay. All right, our next story, and I'm sure we'll get some interesting opinion on Susan from this one. Our good friends at Apple, they're getting a little bit of a backlash because lately, if you have an iPhone 6S, which is not a cheap piece of hardware, let's say you're out of the country somewhere where there's no official Apple store and something happens to your phone. So you have to go get it fixed, and particularly the actual Touch ID sensor or the button on the phone. You get it fixed, you know, great, still works fine. You come home and Apple says, hey, iOS 9's out. Do you want to download it? And you go, sure. Well, after you download it, all of a sudden you get an error 53 and your phone is essentially a brick at that point, because what happens is Apple has disabled your iPhone because apparently there was a non-official hardware upgrade done to this. So you think, okay, I'm a bad boy. Let me just downgrade back to iOS 8. No, it doesn't quite work that way. So they're getting a lot of people who are very pissed off at this. And there's already been talk about a class action because, again, we talk about it's, you know, at least in the UK, it's breached basic consumer laws. Mm-hmm. Because it's essentially the Criminal Damage Act of 1971. This is UK law. A person without lawful excuse destroys or damages any property belonging to another intending to destroy or damage any such property, or being reckless as to whether any such property would be destroyed or damaged, shall be guilty of an offense. And Susan, that is the longest bloody sentence I have seen. must be legal stuff.
Clearly.
Yes. Uh-oh. Susan has notes.
You know what? I thought we would have to, because the
here we go.
Actually, this is why we brought her. Section.
Oh, good.
And of course, it is also. I was thinking, can I memorize this? But no, I can't memorize the
That's all right.
incredibly long sentences in the criminal code.
I know.
But it is interesting. Canada does have a similar section, only we call it mischief. So it's under the mischief laws under Section 430, and the criminal code was actually. I'm going to say upgraded, but it wasn't upgraded. It was updated recently to add a section called mischief to data. So there is actually an entire section in the criminal code that talks about when somebody willfully or purposefully renders data useless, alters, destroys, or makes the data meaningless or ineffective. So there is actually a section in the criminal code that says you can't be doing willfully doing this to somebody else's data.
Essentially that's what you're doing unless by some virtue you somehow backed all of your data up to iCloud, which I think you and I both know, Stuart, and you probably know as well, is not terribly reliable. That's essentially what's happening. There are going to be apps in your phone that only store data locally, and so that data is gone. And ultimately then they're thinking, well, just use the Apple apps. Well, sorry, some of the Apple apps suck, so I don't want to use the Apple app. I should be able to use something else. And if I'm storing it locally for security reasons, perhaps because I've got a passcode on my phone and you know, I know the data is only going to stay there. Well, sorry, I happen to be in, I don't know, Costa Rica or something on vacation. My fingerprint scanner broke. Somebody gave me a replacement that works, though.
Exactly.
And now that I've upgraded to iOS 9, you've bricked my phone. Like, you are
without warning
actually,
you or anything like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, no
exactly.
warning whatsoever. I mean, like, can you at least give me a week or so to, like, take it to the Apple store and, you know, get a proper fingerprint sensor put in.
I don't really even have that kind of proprietary control. I understand, obviously, for profits it's fine, but what they're going to argue is that you signed a contract when you bought your iPhone. And I don't know anybody on this planet, including lawyers, who, when they buy their iPhones, actually read through the 10 or 20 or 30 pages of fine print, which, by the way, precludes you from bringing your device to Cuba. And there's actual sections on terrorism in there as well.
Of course.
Nobody reads those sections. But they're going to say, look, you signed this contract and we're entitled to do this. And then the question becomes, well, can you really contract out of some very basic consumer protection laws?
And I hope for our sake that the courts say, no, you can't. And I think they have before on not this type of issue because this is fairly new, but similar type of things. I mean, I recall a case in the U.S. where basically, we figured out EULAs are useless. Like, you can't enforce them at all. And I have to have a feeling that I know that there are some laws that are, you know, for this type of thing that are very different between the states and Canada. But I think, you know, this sort of situation, it would probably be a similar outcome, if not exactly the same, where you just can't enforce a EULA.
Well, and I think it's one thing to say, look, you've broken your contract, so we're going to end our relationship with you, and actually destroying your personal data that you've stored on their phone. And I think that there's a line, and I think that's way past the line of what a breach of contract outcome should be.
Well, I think we're actually going to find out, because I just see a story here today. Seattle-based law firm PCVA, they have now started a class action.
They jumped right on it right after the within hours of the Guardian posting the original story, and but I mean, you know, I'm like, A, for the law firm, this is a good, probably fairly solid case to go after in the States, offering to represent victims for free. Well, I imagine they're going to get some sort of kickback.
Yeah, I'm thinking that they're going to lean as a contingency fee.
Because we think we're going to win, so we'll take 20%, 30%, 40% of the winnings, which I think is fairly common in these sort of class action lawsuits. So
exactly.
All right.
You know, at the same time, there was a class action a while ago about memory fixing with RAM.
Oh yes.
And they basically invited anyone to go in. You didn't even need a receipt. And I got my check for $20 and it didn't bounce. So hey, there you go.
Memory price fixing.
All right.
RAM and computer.
Price fixing. Yeah, I remember that. Wow. Okay. Okay, moving on. This is kind of a segue, and I wonder, related or not, Apple iPhone trade-in program will start taking broken phones. I wonder if that includes a broken iPhone 6S.
Well, it depends on whether they feel like it's broken or whether you messed it up willingly, I guess.
Exactly.
But yeah, I mean, like, this is nice. You know, so basically, if you wanted to trade in a phone before, it had to be in pretty good shape, right?
Yeah.
So now if you've broken your screen, or does it even need to turn on anymore? I don't even know. But so basically, for damaged phones, they'll actually still give you some cash.
It says $50 for a 5S, $200 for a damaged 6, and $250 for a damaged 6S.
Yeah, I mean, and this makes sense because they're still going to get reusable components out of it. The materials can be recycled, you know, melted down and reused. So, I mean, this is really good for everybody. Is it related to the last story? Maybe.
I just thought it was ironic.
Yeah, it is pretty coincidental. So,
I needed to...
It's good to see. I mean, or even if you bring in an undamaged iPhone 6 Plus, maybe in anticipation of the iPhone 7 this fall, which will inevitably come out, you could get up to $500. So,
that's pretty good.
And $500 is probably going to be for the device that cost you well over $1,000, but at least it's something.
It's $500 back. So, and if you're the kind of person that gets buys an unlocked one every time, that's definitely some savings.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
You can use it for a year, you pay $500 and away you go. So,
yeah. Anything to add, Susan? No, we're good.
Okay. Netflix.
Netflix.
We all love Netflix. Now,
I do love Netflix.
They've started a border crackdown for people using IP services because, you know, some of us in Canada were going to Netflix UK or Netflix US because the catalogs are all different everywhere. I know people in Australia, they found that the catalog was very small, so they were hitting Netflix US. But what's happened is they said, you know, and I, again, it's because of the age-old problem of there's rights holders for different countries, in my opinion, an archaic system. So they started cracking down on these VPN or DNS redirectors, but some of them have actually been able to get their way around. And one I found in particular from the CBC article is that, and this is the issue I have, in some cases it's banning people who aren't switching, but they are legitimately using a VPN for privacy reasons. And that's the part I'm really annoyed with.
Yeah, so, I mean, I didn't see in the story whether those Canadians who were using the VPN services strictly for privacy were still coming at Netflix from a Canadian node.
Right.
That is not clear. So, you know, in that case, I'm not surprised you're getting caught up in this. I have a subscription to ProXPN, and that's a VPN service that's famously does not keep logs whatsoever. Because they don't want to be in a position to have to go to court and say, or, you know, provide some sort of records of, yes, this user did in fact go to X website, and, you know, we have the logs to show it. They just don't want to go down that route at, that route at all, and so they just don't maintain any logs. But regardless, you know, I've used it before, but it's usually for me because I accidentally lock myself out of one of my servers. And so, like, by IP. And so I need to get into the server, reset the password, or take my IP address out of the firewall block. And, I mean, for me, that's my primary use. But occasionally, you know, I need to test things from different locations, making sure things appear as normal. I don't, however, use it for Netflix. I've preferred to say, I'm a Canadian, I'm going to give you Canadian dollars for the Canadian service so that you have additional incentives to bring more content to the Canadian catalog.
Mm-hmm.
So, Susan, do you have a Netflix account?
I do have a Netflix account.
Do you use a VPN?
Confirm or deny that I use any sort of device that may or may not allow me to access outside.
You know, we don't have the Fifth Amendment here.
Yeah.
Hypothetically, if I did, you know, I do think that the article makes an interesting point at the end, which is Netflix is under a lot of pressure from license holders internationally. And like you said, Stuart, I agree that this system is a bit archaic. It made sense, you know, 20 years ago, maybe even 10 years ago, but in the way the world we live in exists today, it doesn't really make sense to have those regional licensing requirements. But they're under a lot of pressure. I think they came out with a lot of noise in a press conference to try to appease some of that pressure. Did they really tackle this wholeheartedly? I'm not sure that they did. So I do think that they're trying to do a little nudge, nudge, wink, wink. I mean, they've even come out and said, look, if you want to share your password with your friends and family, that's fine. So they seem pretty progressive on
some
of these issues.
My in-laws do use our account, but that means we can, no matter what, we can only use two streams right now.
Right.
So we can watch something at home, and they can watch a movie up at their house or a TV show. And so I'm not really breaking anything. I mean, like, they're on the same street, for goodness sake.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
And you're being an excellent son-in-law. So.
I am
right.
being a very
and
good
I think
son-in-law.
Netflix would give you some bonus points and would understand that. So it's interesting. I wonder how much they'll keep fighting, because I think one of the sites said, oh, yeah, it's expected time to resume our services in 6 hours.
And yeah.
They
found a workaround already.
It's like playing whack-a-mole.
Well, it really is.
Yeah,
so.
I mean, like, how do you, except for, you know, looking for host names or IP addresses, you can't really 100% block, like, all the VPN services.
Yeah.
And even then, like, you're still going to be playing whack-a-mole because it's like, well, we'll just change the host name or we'll just get a new IP address and, you know, stop using this old one. Like,
exactly.
Especially as we move to IP version 6, there's billions of IP version 6 addresses. Like, you're never going to be able to block them all.
Yeah.
So, you know, they've made an attempt, probably more so to say, see MGM, see Sony, we tried, we did it. Look at all these news stories about us being jerks and, you know, preventing our customers from using non-native country Netflix services. And that was probably one of the big things they had to do in order to get the international expansion they wanted. I mean, that the other part that day of the, hey, guys, we're actually going to start cracking down, was we're now available in like 130-plus countries. That was huge.
Exactly.
So, yeah, that was probably part of the deal, is you guys actually need to make an effort. So they made an effort. How long will that effort be sustained? We don't know.
Exactly.
Right. So, all right. It'll be interesting to see what happens there. Again, we'll continue to cover that as it moves forwards.
Yeah.
Now, this next one is one I found, and I had noticed this. I'd heard rumors about this before, but
I've done this.
Ever since I know, and I find on my iPhone, because I've got a used iPhone 5, and I really notice this. Researchers have discovered that the Facebook app on the iPhone, it really sucks the battery, even when it's not in use. And I have to admit, I noticed this, and when I first read about this, I basically went, yes, that's what it is. So, so basically what they're saying is, they're saying it it can save up to 15% if you want to install the iOS app and just access Facebook using Safari.
Mm-hmm.
And I have noticed this. I don't have exact numbers, but I've definitely noticed a difference in the battery life. And the thing that's particularly evil is, even if you don't have the app running, it still uses battery. So there's definitely, I think it's a poorly written app. I think that's what the issue is right now. Unless Facebook's got some extra stock in like recharge stations or something, I don't really see a reason for them to really, really want you to suck the battery life, which means you'll spend less time on Facebook.
Yeah, well, so a few weeks ago, I did delete the app, and then I also deleted the Messenger app because
I
don't want to use Facebook Messenger much in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And so, A, I find myself rarely using Facebook, and my life is not any worse without it.
Yep.
And B, my battery life is actually much better now. I mean, when you think about what Facebook's doing, it's, you know, every 5, 10, 15 minutes, it's going to Facebook servers, it's looking for notifications, or it's maintaining an open socket and waiting for notifications to be pushed to you, which is an even bigger battery suck. Because, I got to know right now. You know, if Stuart mentions me in a comment, I need to know right now. And
I mention you a lot. I just don't mention you by name.
Facebooking me or whatever.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Sub-status updating me? I don't know.
I don't know what it's
called. It doesn't really work the way subtweeting does. So, stop Facebooking me behind my back. I find myself rarely on Facebook, which is fine. I go to it when I think of it, which is still several times a week. But I'm no longer part of the billion-plus daily active users, that's for sure. It's just not that important to my life. I'm trying to maintain better in person or over the phone, you know, relationships instead, and I'm getting better battery life out of it in return.
Yeah, I'm finding a similar thing. I've been kind of scaling back. I still, you know, I use it more as the tool in that, but yeah, definitely not obsessively checking it multiple times a day, etc. How about you, Susan? I know you're an active Twitter user. Do you find your social media use is less now?
Well, I just found out about this today, and I'm now contemplating whether or not I want to delete the app, because I do actually have an iPhone 6.
Do it.
And you know, I'm just looking at this picture, because they mentioned if you use it through Safari, and you actually save or bookmark it onto your screen.
Add it to your phone screen.
You can barely tell the difference, and most of what you can do on your app, you can do through the Safari link of minus a couple of
I would argue it's a better experience on the web still. It's a little slower, but in terms of actually using it in the way I want to, I can actually get to the chronological feed on the web, and you can't do that on the app.
They keep adding it, and they keep deleting it.
And it's getting really annoying. Even for me, this was like, I get the side benefit of not having to deal with their algorithm as much.
Oh, absolutely. I was looking through my Facebook feed yesterday and on my phone, and it finally popped up that school buses had been canceled and snow advisory warning, and I was like, your algorithm kind of failed there, because kind of could have used that information before I left to work.
Yeah.
So you're right. It is it'll be interesting if Facebook will address this or not. Because you're right, it doesn't benefit them to drain the battery to this extent. So is this just a development issue, something that slipped through the cracks, or do they not care?
I think it mostly has to do with their thinking that you need an instant notification. And so the amount of traffic that has to go back and forth, not the amount of traffic, how many times, some sort of signal has to go back and forth, like a keep alive signal between the app and their servers. It's basically an all day thing because they think you want to know immediately. Heaven forbid you wait a couple of minutes to know that you've gotten a message or that someone mentioned you in a comment or posted something on your wall or what have you.
If you're in an intense Facebook fight about politics, you may need that instantaneous notification.
No, what you need is a little bit of time to respond instead of reacting.
Wait. You mean there's politics on social media?
No, she's making things up.
If you're not okay for Kim Kardashian stories, but I don't know.
Thank God.
I'm definitely not using it for Kim Kardashian.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, let's turn from something what we don't like, what we like this week. Mine is, I've been going through some stressful times lately, and I've been trying out some different meditation apps. And someone told me about this one called Headspace. Mm-hmm. There is 10 sessions that are free, and then after that it's a subscription service. But it's an app you can use on your computer, your tablet, your phone. And, it's actually worth a try. I'm finding it, I've only been through two of them so far, but I actually find it is kind of easy to kind of start meditating. It's really good when you've got 9 billion things on your plate, which is basically me right now. Definitely worth checking out. And again, we have the link in the show notes. So Derek, what do you have?
So I have a piece of hardware this week. It's the HP Elite X2 1012. Shame on you, HP marketing company or marketing department, for that such a ridiculous name. but a ridiculous name for a really nice looking device. I have spoken to a gentleman named Patrick Moorhead, who used to be an executive at AMD, the CPU makers, mm-hmm. and I think he was the CTO, and he's gone off to form his own company called Moore Insights and Strategy. You'll see him a lot on Forbes and that sort of thing, and he put this on Google Plus a little while ago, and I think it looks really, really nice. The HP Elite X2 1012. Basically, it looks a lot like a Microsoft Surface Book, but not directly from Microsoft. I believe it's a little less expensive, but very similar. So it has the screen itself is basically a tablet, and it can be used in a tablet-type format. It has a kickstand as well, lots of ports, also an attachable keyboard, of course. And then because it's HP, of course, you have all the enterprise-level stuff, like really strong integration with Landesk for help desks and that sort of thing. You can use the fairly new Windows Hello security feature to log in with your face, or there's a fingerprint reader as well. There's also NFC and smart card readers built into the keyboard for other enterprise environments that are using that sort of thing.
Yep.
A whole slew of security and performance devices, and it starts at $1,000.
Oh, sorry, I'm looking at the US one. My apologies.
$1,579 for Windows 10 Pro, an Intel Core M processor, 12-inch screen. So that's a pretty big tablet if you detach it.
Yeah, it's a good size.
It starts at only 4 gigs of RAM, but I imagine you can get more, and 128 gigabyte SSD. So it looks really nice. I'm pretty sure it's a little less expensive than the Surface Book for similar hardware specs. And I'm going to try and convince Brendan to my boss to buy one for me.
There you go. Good luck with that.
Yeah.
Good luck with that.
Well, apparently, he really likes buying gear, so...
Well, there you go.
So hopefully it's not too hard to convince.
Hopefully it should be pretty good. Yeah. Susan, we always invite our guests. Is there any apps or anything you've had your eye on lately?
I am actually going to promote an app by a Canadian lawyer. I think he's a law student when he designed it, but it's called Legal Swipe. And what I like about it is I'm very actively involved in the issue of police carding and street checks and what I call police stops. This app was designed to help people go through their interactions with police, and it actually will take you step by step in terms of what your rights are, gives you some examples of responses that could help you in terms of interacting with police, what you do have to say, what you don't have to say. And I like the fact that it was developed right here at home, and it has a Canadian legal perspective as well. And
that's,
I think,
awesome.
It's really going to show you the future of the law and how it interacts with social media and with apps generally.
That sounds
cool. Yeah,
really,
no.
Cool.
Looks interesting. I've added a note to the show notes, and yeah, I think, you know, one thing is the police have a difficult enough job to do, but at the same time, it's good that all citizens know what their rights are when dealing with it. So
yeah, well, and you don't get it from the Canadian perspective very often. You got a lot of American TV shows and a lot of American built apps and that sort of thing. I mean, like, that's great for, you know, Magna Carta type stuff that, you know, is pretty universally applied, but carding, you know, just being stopped on the street and asked a couple questions, as much as I hope it doesn't happen to me anytime soon or ever, it would be handy just to know how far I do need to go, where I can stop myself.
Exactly. Just again, Derek, as I told you before, just make sure you have Susan on speed dial.
Yeah.
Yes, I do. She's. I've got her phone number in my phone.
There you go. Excellent. Perfect. Okay. So we're just about to finish the show here, and we have a new sponsor this week. But again, it's a relation. There is, we should do a disclaimer. There is a relationship here, but they are an awesome company.
I was going to basically start off with a disclaimer. So Olio Digital Labs is my employer. There's your disclaimer. But the managing partner / my boss, Brendan Farganer, is gracious enough to let me use company time to record the podcast, company facilities. I use the boardroom here. That's why it's a little echoey, but we are working on getting some new hardware to sort that out. And I really do genuinely enjoy working here. And so I'll tell you a little bit about Olio. It's a custom web and mobile application development company. We do a lot of work in retail operations and in e-commerce. What we're really strong at is connecting web and mobile apps to other companies' back-end platforms. So companies like SAP, Microsoft SQL Server, Tableau, Sage Business Vision, pretty much anything that helps run your company, like an ERP system or customer relationship management, a CRM system, we can integrate with it. We can give you or help get you a lot of insight out of your data. That's really where we're really strong. And what you're also going to get with Olio is really experienced advice and execution in helping you plan your applications and the design. Great focus on usability, accessibility, and we have a whole host of experience in dealing with credit card security and making sure that your application or your server is PCI compliant so that you can actually but without angering the credit card companies, take credit card numbers and process
awesome.
Them in a secure way. We really focus on big custom web apps, and we have some really big, good clients who bring us some really unique challenges. So if you're looking for an application or web development partner to help you get insight out of your data, connect systems together, call or email Olio Digital Labs. That's Olio, O-L-I-O, digitallabs.com. Sorry, no promo code. I don't make decisions on pricing, but maybe we can swing something for you if you give us a call.
Perfect. And we'll have some of that contact information and links in the show notes. And we thank them for their support. All right. So this has been an awesome, awesome show. Susan, always a pleasure. You're always welcome back.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yep, always a good time, and as I said, she keeps us out of trouble.
Yeah.
So, all right. So, just before we end up, I just want to remind folks you can find us on most fine podcasting distribution streams, including iTunes. But if you could, we'd like to ask you a favor. Please rate and like the podcast if you like it. And if you're dealing with a sponsor, something mentioned that you heard about us here, it does help us a great deal. So, yeah. All right. So, for episode 59 on Friday, February the 12th, 2016, for the Canadian Tech Podcast, my name is Stuart Clark.
My name is Derek Silva.
And my name is Susan Toth.
Thank you and be well.